Hey, future doctors, welcome back to Spoonful of Sugar. We have an amazing episode in store for you today on a much-needed topic. Let's let the hosts introduce themselves and take it away.
Hey, future doctors, thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Akiva Aleph. I'm a third-year student at Ohio University in Cleveland, and I'll be your host today. This is episode 2 of a 3-part series on stats for USMLE and COMLEX. In this episode, we'll look to explain study designs and when to use the equations that we already discussed in part 1. Let's start by getting right into the study designs. First one we'll talk about is a case series. What is a case series? So a case series is going to be a grouping of case reports. As we know, case reports are one-off interesting cases that you either experience clinically or you help, you know, a PI or a preceptor work up. But the bottom line is that they do not show risk factor association. They're simply clinical experiences. All right. The second one we're going to talk about is cross-sectional. So what is a cross-sectional study? This is a study done at the present moment, at a slice in time. So if you were at a slice time right now and freeze it, what is the current disease prevalence? And again, what was prevalence? We talked about in the first episode. Prevalence is the current amount of disease present in the population. And so again, so we're going to take a slice in time, freeze it, and we're going to look at the current disease prevalence and what risk factors are associated with it. So can this show causality? No, it cannot show causality because it is very weak to confounding factors. So all we know is right now what we can see in front of us. We do not know how to, or we're not able to exclude outside input. The next study we're going to talk about is something called case control. Case control may sound really familiar because in episode 1, we talked about a certain measure called odds ratio, right? So a case control is measured with an odds ratio. So is case control retrospective or prospective? It is retrospective, which means retro, backwards, spective, being viewed. So this is a study that is being viewed with data collected historically, so prior to this point in time. So it's a retrospective study that compares, right, you guessed it, cases and controls. And that's the name, case control study. In other words, people with disease versus those without the disease. This is great for evaluating if people with disease had higher exposure to any of the risk factors in question. So now for a second, let's go back and consider the odds ratio, which we used to measure this study, right? And we talked about it last episode. We said the odds ratio will look at people with lung cancer and said, what are the odds? Historically, you are a smoker. And now it makes sense, right? Now you're with me because we talked all about last episode about odds ratio. Now we're going to talk about how to apply it in the cases and case control. And so same for both of them. We're looking at, yes, disease is present. Now, what risk factors do they have? All right. The next one we're going to talk about is cohort. A cohort study uses which type of measure? And again, this was in episode 1 as well. It uses something called relative risk. So a cohort study is it retrospective or prospective? All right, hopefully everyone caught on that was actually a trick question. It is both retrospective or prospective, but it is used to record data from the viewpoint of we know they have or had risk factor X. Now let's see what happens. In other words, we know that this group smokes. They are chronic smokers. We know they have the risk factor. And this group does not smoke. So we know that we're comparing, right? We're comparing two cohorts. One cohort we know has exposure. One cohort we know does not have exposure. Now we're going to follow up and see if the smoking cohort develops cancer at a higher rate. Or any other disease that you want to end up using this data for, but that's how it's collected. So here we use relative risk, which, as I hope you remember, is the measure defined as risk inherent to certain exposures. And this makes a lot of sense now that we're talking about the study, because in this example of smoking, we could say that a smoker has, and again, these numbers are made up, but a smoker has 10 times higher risk than a non-smoker for developing lung cancer. And we know this because we assigned the groups based on risk factor, and then we got the numbers on disease incidence. Okay. And again, incidence, as we discussed in the last episode, is the measure, the proportion of new onset disease cases in a population. The next study design we're going to talk about is one I know we're all a little more familiar with. It is randomized control. So what is a randomized control study? Yes, it is experiments. These are the only ones that can prove causation. That is the key takeaway here. Everything else and every other study has correlation or association, etc. But only a randomized control experiment can isolate risk factors or treatments and remove confounding factors to the point of assigning causation. So here, if you built the trial appropriately, you could say smoking causes lung cancer versus simply assigning risk values. For example, like we said in the last case, that smokers may have 10 times higher risk of developing lung cancer, etc. But it doesn't say it causes it. But if you were to design this study appropriately in a randomized control experiment, you could say definitively there is causation. Smoking causes lung cancer. We'll get into a little side note here, which is the phases of clinical trials. This comes up on boards every now and then. You'll definitely see it in practice questions. And I think it's important to be, broadly speaking, familiar with the phases. So we'll start with phase zero, which is the first phase. So what is phase zero? Phase zero is a small number of participants which are being used to simply establish pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics. Phase one, which is the second stage here, is still very small participants. This is dose safety testing, also known as LD50, for example, lethal dose 50, or max tolerated dose. The next stage is stage two. This is where it starts to get more interesting. Here it's randomized and controlled with a higher number of participants. Researchers will start to hone in on the efficacy. Does this intervention truly work? Phase three, this is the one that we've all heard of. This is the bread and butter of clinical trials. This is large number of participants, random, controlled, double blinded. This stage tests whether the efficacy is superior to current market options. So the previous phase says, does this drug work at all? Period. This phase, phase three, says, is it better than what's out there? And maybe you're comparing it to nothing, right? Maybe there is no option on the market right now, in which case you would hope it would be better. But perhaps there is a drug on the market and we're saying, is this actually superior to that drug? And finally, phase four, which is the last one here, is long-term market research. The drug is now available to the public. Everyone's using it. Now we're just kind of sitting back and watching. Does any new or unknown surprising side effect or long-term issue arise? And those are the phases of clinical trial. Back to study designs. Now we're going to talk about kind of subsets of our randomized control experiments. And these are kind of tricky if it's the first time you're seeing it, but they're also kind of intuitive. So I hope you stick with me through this. The first thing we'll talk about is intention to treat. So you're going to hear these next few terms in an effort to confuse you on board exams. But you simply follow the outline of what we have discussed already, with the minor difference of recognizing which values, so to speak, count. So intention to treat means you count everyone in the clinical trial in the group they were initially assigned to, regardless of their follow-through. Meaning, if someone did not take the medication as directed, they are still counted, regardless of the fact that it will dilute the study results. Okay? That is the first set. The second term we're going to talk about here is as treated. What do we think as treated sounds like? Right. So these people are only counted per the treatment they genuinely received. This also introduces bias, by the way, because you assign them to a group beforehand and all of a sudden they're doing different treatment and you count them in the different treatment because that's as treated. But then you're lacking data from the original group they were assigned. And the final one we're going to talk about is per protocol. And what is per protocol? Per protocol is these studies exclude, they actually get rid of, they don't count the data from individuals who did not complete their assigned treatments for any reason. It actually doesn't matter what your reason is. You're gone. We're not counting you. And will that introduce bias? Yeah, absolutely. That's going to introduce bias. Is it better than the opposite idea where if these people didn't actually do what they were supposed to do, should we count them anyway? Not necessarily. So that's why you have these three different terms. You have intention to treat, as treated, and per protocol. And it's the job of the study design maker, producer, scientist, doctor, to come up with which ones they actually want to use in order to try to mitigate any chances of bias introduction. All right. Those are the study designs. That's all of them. That's what you need to know for boards. You could go back and re-listen to that. Try to recognize which ones have equations that go hand in hand with them. For example, right, the case control uses odds ratio, the cohort uses relative risk, etc. But that's what you need to know. The next subject we're going to talk about in this episode is something that we kind of just touched on a little bit, but we're going to get really into it here, is biases. So what is bias? Bias is any issues or concerns being introduced into a study that will impact the results, whether the interpretation of the results or the actual collection of data, etc. Let's get right into it. Biases. The first one we're going to talk about is selection bias. So every study is based on trying to emulate a population through a selected sample. This means you can have poor sample selection and therefore it would simply not represent the population, right? If you're trying to look at all of America and you pick one minor city and try to extrapolate from there, it won't necessarily represent the population at an appropriate level. So within selection, there are two subsets of biases that we should talk about. First one is Berkson. Has anyone heard of Berkson's bias? So Berkson bias is a specific form of selection bias relevant to medical studies that entail choosing your sample from a hospital. What does that mean? I'll give you an example. What if you wanted to test MRSA cases in a population, but all of the cases that you selected are from hospitalized patients? Your whole sample size is from hospitalized patients. And your control group, let's say, is from non-hospitalized patients. Well, you're going to get a whole lot more MRSA cases from the hospitalized patients than the non-hospitalized patients. The way I kind of think of this is Berkson sounds like some fancy hospital center somewhere. So I call it Berkson's hospital. The next term we'll talk about is attrition. And again, this is still within the selection category. So attrition, which the word attrition means loss. So it's simple enough to understand that this bias comes into play when you're doing a longitudinal study, or example, or longitudinal meaning long-term, so over an extended period of time, and you lose follow-up to any of the sample participants for any reason. Someone stops answering their emails. They don't send in the questionnaire that they're supposed to send in at the 6-month follow-up. They pass away if you're studying a certain disease. Any of these reasons are called attrition. All right, let's move on to the next category. The next one we'll talk about is recall. What do we think recall sounds like? Well, recall, really simply, is very relevant to retrospective studies. So again, remember we talked about before, retrospective means back, way back when. And it comes into play when a participant simply does not recall info accurately. In other words, humans forget things. There's no way around that. And if you're questioning someone about certain risk factors that they may or may not have been exposed to 50 years ago, odds are you're going to introduce bias. All right. The next one we're going to talk about is measurement bias. So measurement bias is the method of data collection is flawed for any reason. For example, you used a bad thermometer when testing body temperature. It could be as simple as that. The data was miscollected. A subset of this, which is a really important one, is called Hawthorne bias. And again, this is a form of measurement bias. So Hawthorne is where the people in the study are inherently aware that they are being watched or tested, and they act differently because of it. So imagine that you have a room full of people and they're supposed to be putting together puzzles, and they figure out that the mirror on the wall is really one-way glass and the scientists are watching, and all of a sudden they start looking over their shoulder, acting paranoid, and the data just, you're introducing bias all over the place. So the way I think of this, especially to help differentiate it from previous ones, is Hawthorne sounds like the name of some, I don't know, professor somewhere, who's a little too full of himself maybe, and he's collecting data and watching people. So he's the scientist behind the one-way mirror, and his name is Hawthorne. That's how I remember it. The next one we'll talk about is a different category. This is procedure bias. Procedure bias is introduced by treating the groups differently. So the procedure of the study, for example, the treatment group has better living conditions than the control group, and that might affect outcomes, right? There are lots of examples for this, but simply put, it's when the procedure for collecting data or for observation or anything is just different between the two groups. Immediately, that introduces bias. The next one we'll talk about is observer expectancy bias. What does that sound like? Well, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's when an observer expects certain results. So if a researcher expects positive results from a treatment, they may document a higher efficacy than is truly present. This is a great reason for something called double blinding clinical trials. So even the researchers do not know who is in the treatment versus placebo group. All right, so single blind is the sample or the participants in the study don't know whether they're receiving true medication or placebo. Double blind is when the people handing out the pills don't know if they're handing out medication or placebo. So no one knows except for some computer algorithm somewhere. All right. Confounding bias. Everyone's heard the term confounding, right? So let's talk about it. What is confounding bias? So this is a common term when conducting a study. Is you have the study, you let's say, for example, you study the association between baseball and beer. You might say baseball causes people to drink more beer since it is a highly associated habit. However, you may have failed to consider that most foods served at a baseball game are very high in salt, right? Hot dogs, peanuts, etc. And therefore, the beer may actually be caused by thirst and not the game, right? So confounding bias introduces something, and that tells us, well, we could say there's an association. We really can't say there's a causation, because someone drinking a beer at a baseball game might just be really thirsty and that's what's available. It might not be baseball inherently encourages people to drink beer. A subset of confounding bias is something called effect modification. What does effect modification sound like? To me, effect modification sounds like you're changing something and it's giving you a very different outcome. So this is when a secondary factor greatly impacts the results. For example, if you look at beer drinking at baseball games for all attendees, the associative significance is going to be pretty poor, actually, right? I mean, everyone knows we drink beer at baseball games, but if you're looking at everyone who walks through the door, the proportion of people drinking beer is actually pretty low. However, if you collect all that data and then all of a sudden you use something called effect modification, and now you're only looking at attendees over the age of 21, all of a sudden you're going to have really significant results, because let's say almost everyone over the age of 21 is going to have a beer at a baseball game, and you've cut out everyone who inherently can't drink beer in the first place. All right, that is effect modification, and that wraps up the confounding bias group. The next one we'll talk about is lead time bias. And this one gets really confusing because the last one we'll talk about is length time bias. So what's the difference between lead time and length time? Well, lead time is earlier detection of disease, and it implies longer survival times, but it does not take into account severity of disease. Versus length time, which is screening tests, will be more likely to be positive for a disease with a long latency period, or in other words, slow developing disease, than a rapidly progressive disease. Because someone has disease that's rapidly progressive, you're not going to screen them because they're already, let's say, symptomatic. You're just going to do a diagnostic test. You're not going to screen them. So if you're screening everything that walks through the door, you're introducing bias for very slow developing latent disease as opposed to the rapidly progressive disease. And the lead time is that the earlier we detect a disease makes us think that survival times are longer, but doesn't take into account severity of disease. So some diseases just have long survival time. And if we're catching it really, really early in the course, you're going to have a really long survival time. But truthfully, it just might not be as severe at that point. And when we catch it later on, it might be more severe, and then survival time would be much shorter. Those get a little bit confusing, those last two, but as long as you can appreciate the difference between what the two of them are trying to say, you'll be fine. All right, that's actually all of the biases. So in this episode, we really talked about the study designs. We mentioned some of the equations from the first episode and how they play into the different study designs. And then we talked all about bias and how bias gets introduced very commonly into studies. So I'll leave you with two questions. First one, what type of bias is introduced when a participant knows they are being observed? The answer to this one is Hawthorne, right? Because that interesting Professor Hawthorne is watching everyone and making them nervous. All right. Last question. What type of study design is best for studying a rare disease? Bonus points if you can figure out why. Yeah, so with rare disease, you actually want to do a case control study. As for why, well, that disease, that study design specifically, we're looking at cases, in other words, disease present, yes, versus controls, in other words, disease not present. So if you have a super rare disease, it's really hard to pick risk factors and then try to see if they develop disease, right? Because it's just too rare. You're going to waste time, money, effort. It's very impractical. However, if you are trying to study a rare disease and you look at like, oh, here, you know, we'll go to a specialist clinic and they have 10 people with this disease. All right, great. We can look at these 10 people, these 10 cases of disease positive, and we can then look at, hey, what risk factors did you have? Maybe there's something in common here that the 10 of you had, and now you all have this disease. So you want to use a case control study design. All right. Thank you for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember, if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.